Hey there, listeners. This is Justin with a quick note before today's episode. We're going to be hosting a live seminar. It's going to be held by video on June 19th. That's Wednesday, June 19th. It'll be 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. It's going to be 90 minutes. This first seminar is hosted by Amgen. We're going to have three different team members with three different roles, with three different backgrounds, all veterans on the live panel. And just like on the show, I'm going to do 45 minutes of Q&A with the three of them. And then we're going to take 45 minutes and open it up to the audience to answer any and all questions that you have. If you have any interest whatsoever in about Amgen, about the biotech and medical services industry, about functional roles that are universal across every industry, I'd really encourage you to join. I would love to see you there, add some faces to some names, and have your participation. I think you're going to learn a lot, and we're very, very excited to kick this off. And also very grateful for Amgen's support, because by sponsoring this panel, they're helping us expand our work over here at Beyond the Uniform. And all of this is 100% free for you to join. So costs nothing. You can register through our newsletter, or look for a link on the site. Hope to see you there. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to help military veterans thrive in their civilian career. I do that by interviewing military veterans about their civilian career, what they do, how they got there, and advice for other veterans seeking to do the same. Today's episode number 275 with Brian Knight.
The Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge is a 3,000-mile ocean rowing race that starts from La Gomera, Canary Islands, to Antigua. And me and my team, there was four of us together, all military veterans, were the first military veteran team to ever row an ocean. The race starts from La Gomera, and it's an ocean rowing race. And our boat was 28 feet long, and we spent 54 days, 9 hours, and 3 minutes on crossing the ocean.
In this interview, we talk about the oil and gas industry, the different aspects of this massive field, and why veterans may like the mission-focused approach of this industry. We also talk about Brian's participation in a 3,000-mile rowing race as the first military veteran team to row an ocean as part of the Fight or Die team. As always, at beyondtheuniform.org, you'll find show notes with links to everything we discuss in this episode, as well as a text transcript. And special thanks to BPhil2, who in May 2018 wrote on Apple Podcasts and iTunes, "Just thank you for what you do. This is without a doubt the best veteran transition resource for those thinking about making the jump. I listened to all your episodes and it has given me such great insights. You are really making a difference. It's like having a network of mentoring discussions in each episode. Thank you so much, BPhil2, for that review on Apple Podcasts. Very much appreciate all of those, all of you who have left great positive reviews. It helps us get the word out about the show. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Bryant. Joining me today in Castle Rock, Colorado, just about 30 minutes away from where I'm at in Denver, my guest is Bryant Knight. Bryant, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And so for listeners, a quick background on Bryant. He is a senior account manager, Rocky Mountains, for Leem Drilling Systems. He served in the Army for nearly 24 years. He started out as a flight medic, became an artillery officer, and then served as Special Forces Commander for the 20th Special Forces Group. Bryant, maybe to start things off, you spent over 20 years in the Army. You served your last 12 years in the Special Forces as a Green Beret. Since retirement, you spent the last 7 years in the oil and energy industry. Could you walk us through what that transition was like from the military and what led you to pursue a career in the oil and energy industry?
So I think the transition, into oil and gas was probably the easiest thing I've ever done. Just hindsight 2020 now, it's the goal for oil and gas is very mission focused. And that's, I think that's something that a lot of military veterans can understand and get behind. You know, for me, I mean, I'm on the drilling side of oil and gas. And so, you know, we have a mission of drilling oil wells. And so we do that. And it was just very understandable, you know, hey, we got to drill this well. This is what you got to do to get there. And you plan and you execute. And it's very similar to living a life of, you know, of a military soldier.
When you, you know, knowing that you wanted to go into oil and gas, how did you approach that job search? How did you, like, what led you to Lehm Drilling Systems?
You know, I was pretty lucky. I was actually deployed. I was in Baghdad. I was in Northern Iraq at the time. And my brother had been with the company, Lehm Drilling Systems, for a few years prior, you know, and I spoke to him quite a bit on Skype. And I came in, you know, after a mission, and I looked all haggard and worn out. And I remember my brother saying, you know, hey, when are you going to get tired of doing that kind of stuff? And why don't you come out to the oil and gas industry and start a civilian career? And, you know, I think that was about time I was ready to do that, you know, after three combat deployments, one in Afghanistan, two in Iraq, and, you know, multiple training, you know, events going on. I wasn't home a lot. So my wife, my family was, I just wasn't seeing my family like, you know, a family man should. And so it was an easy, you know, decision. And I did my interview via Skype with the company that I'm working with now. While I was there, I got hired while I was overseas. And, you know, when I started my transition out, you know, I just walked right into the job. I worked in the field, in the oil and gas field, for about a year and a half in North Dakota. It's funny because I say, you know, I left Baghdad, or I left Iraq, and it was 140 degrees, you know, on the hottest days. And, you know, I went to 40 below zero, in North Dakota. And so it was a huge transition and getting used to the climate. But, you know, it's an exciting, industry. There's a lot of avenues, that, you know, someone that wants to get into oil and gas, that they, you know, they can approach, you know, whether it be on the drilling side, or whether it be on the completions, whether it be midstream, you know, even they can just get into land management. I mean, there's so many different, you know, avenues for oil and gas for a veteran to get into. But I took the, you know, I filled out the application while I was over there. I got hired and I went to work, and, you know, I asked my, I came home and my wife said, well, how long are you going to be home? And I said, well, you know, a couple of weeks, and then I'll go to the field and work. And so I spent the next 3 to 4 weeks before I came back home. And I did that for, like I said, a year, year and a half, you know, three or four weeks on, about a week or two off, and then just kind of back and forth from the field. And my wife liked that because she called it mini deployments. So we kind of laugh about that now. But, you know, after a while, you know, learning the job, I met with the owner of the company, and we had a long sit down, and, you know, he offered me the Rocky Mountain, area. And, you know, I said, yeah, cause you know, just, it was a growth, move. And, here I am today.
That's awesome. How would you explain, if you bumped into someone who's, you know, maybe recently out of the military or on active duty, and they said, hey, what do you do as a senior account manager? How would you answer that?
So, you know, I cover all the sales within the Rocky Mountains. And, you know, so every operator, drilling operator, or energy operator that's here in Denver, I call on. And so once you acquire those accounts, you know, then you put personnel out on location. You ensure that, you know, all the logistics is done. You ensure that that account is maintained, you know, while you work, while you're working for them. And then, you know, it's just a steady, you know, constant maintenance, and keeping the client happy.
And so are you kind of constantly driving to different drilling locations and checking to see how things are going, or is it more interfacing with the client and just kind of checking in and giving them updates? Like what's that look like on a day-to-day basis?
So I sit on both sides of that fence. I'm on the corporate side where, you know, I'm in the office and I'm talking to decision makers, you know, at the you know, drilling manager level, the VP operations level, you know, some of the smaller operators, you'll just talk directly to the C-suite guys. And then there's those days where I'm out in the field and you're talking to the drilling superintendents and, you know, operations superintendents and, you know, the company men that are actually out there on the rigs. And, you know, we have coordinators that, you know, that's their main responsibility is to work with those individuals. And, you just want to be able to maintain those relationships and foster those relationships. At the same time, you want to make sure that, you know, your guys are doing the right thing and doing a good job. So you got to stay on point with, you know, both corporate and, you know, out in the field.
Mm. And I believe you're the first guest I've had on the show in the oil and gas space, or maybe the second. But I'm curious, you mentioned at the start, you said, hey, there's a lot of different aspects of oil and gas. For someone like myself or someone listening who's not familiar with the oil and gas industry, could you kind of high level the different opportunities? You talked about the field work, you talked about account management. Mm-hmm. What other buckets are there so the listener can maybe get some bearings and dig deeper with one that might resonate with them?
Well, you know, there's land management. So, you know, the term is land man. And those are individuals who go out and, you know, they work with the landowners. They go to the courthouses and they delve into, you know, who owns the mineral rights for the property that, you know, the area where, you know, a company is interested in drilling. And so they'll do all that research. They will secure the rights, you know, via lease or purchase. And, you know, so there's that aspect of it. And then, you know, there's the, you know, you have, there's a, it's oil and gas is very engineering centric. So there's, petroleum engineering degrees that, you know, people that want to get their education out of the military, that want to get their education, they can get into petroleum engineering, and they can become, you know, drilling engineers. They can become completions engineers, production engineers. And these are, you know, for the engineering professional, that, you know, it's usually, those are usually entry level engineering degrees, or engineering jobs. And then, you know, they migrate up through just a normal chain of command, you know, structure where, you know, I can speak the drilling engineer very well. So it's drilling engineer, it's drilling manager. Then you get into VP of operations. So companies, large companies, the super majors like BP and Exxon and these large companies, you know, they get out and they look for, they really want the experience of a military veteran. And then if it's tied in with someone who has a drilling, you know, engineering degree or an engineering background, then it's, you know, those are highly sought after individuals for pretty much every operator out there. And that's from the super majors to the smaller companies. Mm. 'Cause you got to have them. You can't do it without them.
That's great. And
then, so there's, and that's on the operator side. And so you've got all these services that are provided. So I provide a service to the operator. I provide what's called directional drilling. And, you know, you hear the term horizontal drilling, and that's what we do. So we essentially work with the customer, the operator, the drilling engineer. We build and help design the well bore. So, you know, it's it's very, you know, computer based. We design it via computer, kind of like a CAD system, but it's specifically for, you know, well bores. And so we work with the customer on that, and we build that form, and then we actually go out to the drilling rig when it's time for us to go out there, and we'll drill that section of the well.
If someone listening, this intrigues them, do you have any thoughts on the pros and cons, or especially for someone on active duty who's a year out from transitioning, what are things that they might love about this type of job? What are some things that might drive them crazy?
You know, it's not being in the military, you know, and I think anybody that's ever been in the military, they understand that there's long periods of boredom and then there's those short periods of excitement. So there's a lot of that, I think, that goes on in oil and gas. You're not, you know, the days of being the warrior, you're hanging up the uniform. You still have that warrior mentality, but you know, it's time to change, and it's time to move on. It's time to, you know, grow in your civilian career. And so you need to put those tools to work. And if you're able to do that, I think oil and gas sector is really good, and it's a great transition because, like I said earlier, you know, everyone has, there are goals established. There's a mission set for you. You understand what that is, and it's just not a lot of, for someone that's been in the military that understands, you know, those things, that understands that you got to have a plan, and you got to be able to execute a plan. And then that there's results that come from all that, you know, that is what oil and gas is about for the industry. So if you're, I would tell, you know, someone that's a year out, I'd say this is probably one of the best industries to be in my opinion. I've certainly enjoyed it. You know, it's been really nice for, you know, for me and my family. I mean, you do, you're able to, it can be very lucrative, and, you know, I'd say it's a good, it's a good way of life.
That's awesome. And to shift gears just a little bit, I understand that you completed a 3,000-mile Atlantic Rowing Challenge as part of what's called, I believe, the Talisker Whiskey Challenge. Could you share a little bit more about how this came about and what this whole endeavor was?
Yeah, so... the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge is a 3,000-mile ocean rowing race that starts from Lago Mare, Canary Islands, to Antigua. And me and my team, there was four of us together, all military veterans, were the first military veteran team to ever row an ocean. And, you know, something we're real proud of. We started a team called Fight or Die. And Fight or Die is a nonprofit organization based in Colorado. It's a national brand, it's a national product. So we have, you know, the 2018 team. I mean, you had two people from Colorado and two people from Wyoming that were on that team. But we've got 2019 already established, and we have 2020 established, and working on my first all-female veteran team. Which I'm really proud of. They're coming together nicely. That team's coming together, you know, it's about halfway, about 50% full. And then we're working on an adaptive athlete team. So the race starts from La Gomera, and it's an ocean rowing race. And our boat was 28 feet long, and we spent 54 days, 9 hours, and 3 minutes on crossing the ocean.
But who's counting?
And, you know, we landed in the Caribbean in Antigua, Barbuda. And so, you know, the reason why we did it, every one of us on the team, you know, we've experienced some loss of a friend due to suicide or you know, just lost their personal battle, their personal war with depression and PTSD or PTS. So we partnered with the University of Denver, the Stern Specialty of Military Psychology. We're actually, while we're out there rowing, we're actually conducting research that can be applied and is, you know, currently being studied by that program to see, you know, what we can do to prevent these problems. And it's the only program like it in the United States over at the University of Denver. And when we heard about it, we were like, okay, we can get behind that. We can help raise money and we can help get our veterans to that program that need it. You know, not a lot of veterans qualify for VA assistance, and some of them can't get, you know, that needed therapy that's out there. And so we fill the gap, or, you know, we at least try to do our best. You know, we're a brand new nonprofit, and if anybody's ever been in the nonprofit world, it's not easy raising money. I spend just as much time working with the nonprofit than I do in oil and gas, and I'm always busy. So, but I enjoy it. I love working, staying with the community, and I think it's something that, we all raised our right hand and we swore an oath when we joined the military, and, you know, we understand service. And service doesn't end when you get it, when you hang up the uniform. Service continues. And so I think that's what Fight or Die is about. Everybody on the Fight or Die crew and on the board and on the executive team, it's all 100% volunteer. And so every dime that we raise goes directly to the operation, the Scenic Four, a new set of veterans to race this race and support Stern Specialty of Military Psychology. And we have a new, our latest strategic partner is the Marcus Institute of Brain Health. So that's out of the Anschutz Medical Facility. And what they do is they treat veterans and athletes with TB that have, been exposed to TBI. And so we're very proud of that too. And so, Those are two organizations that Fight or Die champions right now. We're just growing. We're actually, it's kind of exploded, to tell you the truth. It's been really fun to watch.
It's I think it's incredible to do. I mean, the feat itself of 54 days, 9 hours, 3 minutes on a boat is unbelievable. 3,000 miles. I'll include links for listeners, but you'll see the small craft that they're doing this in, which you think of that, you know, being on a submarine out in the middle of the ocean was one thing, but being on this tiny rowboat in the middle of the ocean, it's mind-boggling. And then to be doing that for such a worthy cause, I think is awesome. And I love your thought on service doesn't end when you take off the uniform. And I also want to clarify for listeners, it's Fight or Die. It's with instead of O-R-O-A-R, so great play on words there. Could you take us through what it was like preparing? Like, what was your training schedule like? How long did you have to train for this? And also, how are you able to juggle the training with your full-time job?
Well, that was really tough. And I think it was tough with everybody on the team. You know, we all knew what was required. We all held each other to, you know, our self-imposed standards of staying in shape, and rowing and learning a little bit about the ocean and getting, you know, taking those courses, the race requirements. So you're required to take nautical navigation courses. You're required to take seamanship courses. You're required to take sea survival courses. Let's see, what else did we do? Oh yeah, we had a company called D-Day Response Group. They're another military veteran company out of Florida that trains boat captains, sport fishing captains, sailors, and medical medical treatment. And they're former Special Forces medics, so they've got a really good program. We partnered with them, and they trained us for 3 or 4 days. And so going back to, you know, using our time wisely, we worked. All of us had jobs. And we trained in the gym, a lot of core strength, a lot of CrossFit, a lot of, you know, the stuff that keeps you strong. A lot of time on the rower, you know, I think I've seen all of the, Game of Thrones episode seasons on a rower. I've watched all of the Hobbit movies on the rower. So, I mean, if you can imagine being on a rowing machine for 3 hours at a time, that's kind of what you needed to do. And so, but at the same time, you need to maintain weight, because you lose a lot of weight out at sea. I lost 34 pounds while I was out there. So I went in at 195 pounds and came back, you know, just a little over 160 pounds. So that was, you know, you got to prepare for that. So you get strong, you get healthy, you stay healthy. You do a lot of rowing, you train, what the race requires you to train in. And that's all the nautical stuff I was just telling you about. And then you juggle work and family and everything else. And, you know, it seems impossible, but it's very doable. You know, you just gotta, you gotta have a plan, and you gotta be able to execute that plan. And the plan may not work, but because sometimes it didn't. And you just have to adjust fire on that. And that's okay too. Mm. You know, just, you gotta be flexible. And then, so what, the way we did it, and the way that I think we're going to continue to do it with the next teams, we'll hold we had a 3-week train up. So we developed a, you know, a period of instruction for that train up. And if it's just like looking at any other military training schedule, we treated it just like that. And, you know, where everything by the hour, you know, there was something to do. And, you know, we did it for everybody. The team goes down with the boat to Mobile, Alabama. We partnered with the Buccaneer Yacht Club, and, you know, we trained for 3 weeks. And by the time our training was complete, we were ready to, you know, to cross an ocean. We sent the boat to South Carolina, to Charleston. It got put on a freighter, and then it headed to La Gomera, and we met it in La Gomera, you know, the 1st of December. Mm.
What was the, I'm like thinking through this, what was the most challenging part? I'm thinking of the hours and hours on the rowing machine. I'm thinking of just the incredible physical and mental feat of just staying motivated for nearly 2 months. What did you find most challenging about all of this?
Well, before the race, or are you asking before the race, or are you asking during the race?
Maybe during, I guess.
Okay, because there's, I mean, I can answer both.
Yeah, actually, but
during the race, both, I would say. Yeah. And, you know, during the race, just getting, you know, man, it took us so much time to get, you know, all the planning, everything to get ready for the race. And when we were finally there, we show up to La Gomera with the boat. The name of our boat's called the Whoopi. And when we showed up with the Whoopi, we were just, you know, super excited. And you got all this buildup for the race. I mean, the Talisker is well done. It's a global race. Everybody, it's big in Europe and in the UK, and so not a lot of advertisement in the United States, but the rest of the world, the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge is a very well known race. And so, you know, going through all that hype and going through all the media, but these are things that we weren't used to. You know, we were just, we kind of laugh about it, because we just said, you know, hey, we're just a bunch of knuckle draggers, and you know, we just want to get this thing going. And so there was the build up to that. And then once the race starts, and you know, that first 24 hours, I can't even remember the first 24 hours of the race, because everybody was just so amped and so stoked. And we wanted to get as much distance away from that island as we could. And, you know, that was a lot of fun. I would say the most challenging of it all, was probably the boredom. We got into the doldrums for about 16 days and, the water was just calm. I mean, it was glass. You could ski on it. There was no wind, you know, there was a slow current and it was pushing us to the north and we had to deploy a parachute anchor so we could, you know, just hold. And when you're rowing in that kind of water, it's like rowing in liquid concrete, in wet concrete. And so it was really complicated. It was really hard and we weren't going where we needed to go. So we sat there for, you know, the first time was 5 days and the second time was around, I think 10 or 11 days, something like that. But anyway, doldrums for 16 days. And that was horrible. That was just, you know, you try to stay busy. You try to do priorities of work on the boat, you know, keep the boat clean, keep your equipment clean, keep yourself clean. You try to keep the morale up with the rest of the crew, your crewmates. You know, I would say that was probably the most challenging time for the team. The rest of the race, we were, the first 2 weeks, I mean, gosh, we were in high seas and we were making some really good ground. You know, it was exciting. I mean, it was everything that we thought it would be, you know. I mean, we, you know, 20 to 30 foot seas. I mean, and it, you know, you're rowing and you're climbing up these big swells and you're coming down the swell and back up the swell. And that was just a lot of fun. And then we get into the doldrums and then, you know, everyone else starts passing us. And then that was a little demoralizing. And then that's when we decided, you know, hey, this is going to be our race. And the whole intent, you know, for us to be here anyway, is just to cross an ocean and show our fellow veterans that we can do it, that anything's possible. And, you know, so it became our race and that was okay. And we, you know, once we got past the doldrums, we got back into some decent water, some decent current. The wind started picking up, weather started coming in our favor. And weather is such a major factor in this race. You know, the way that the currents are going and the way that the wind blows really helps direct where that boat's going to go. And it's not a sailboat by any means. There's no sail, there's no motor. It's just you and the oars that you're using. So you know, we were, once we got into better water, you know, you see morale start picking up, and, you know, you're really appreciating, you know, what you're actually witnessing out there. I mean, you know, the sunrises and the sunsets were unbelievable. The stars at night where there's zero light pollution. I mean, unbelievable. I can't even put words to it to really truly describe how powerful that was. The marine life that was around you constantly. I mean, you know, there were at least 3 days in a row where we had a pod of minke whales that just swam next to us. You know, I think they just liked the sound of, you know, the sound of the oars hitting the water. It was relaxing and they would stay with us. That was really cool. Dolphins, you know, we had multiple pods of dolphins that would come and just be curious and, it was just a lot of fun. That was truly, truly a wonderful experience. Something that is life changing.
That's great. And I know that Fight or Die's mission was to increase awareness of and support for the cognitive, behavioral, and physical health of U.S. military and veteran personnel. How do you see your team having impacted that? And how do you look to the future of the impact you want to have on that cause?
Yeah. So, that's a great question too. So, you know, I think when we first started out and being Americans, cause there's only been like 19 Americans. Before we raced, there were only 19 Americans who have ever rode an ocean. So there's not a lot of knowledge on them. No one is, you know, was brand new to anybody that's ever heard it. It was brand new to me when I first found out about it. But when you say you're going to row an ocean, people are like, well, what? What are you guys going to do? And that was kind of neat. But I think when we started telling people the why we were doing it, you know, giving them the why of the reason why we're rowing the ocean, you know, that was more powerful. And so it started to grow. I mean, we started, you know, that started to, word started to get out, and it was really cool to watch because, you know, our mission was pretty simple. You know, we want to be an ocean rowing team that raises awareness, and that supports, programs that work. And so far we've only found two of these programs that work. There's others out there. I'm not saying that there's not, but these are the ones that we've decided to get behind and support. And, you know, going through, looking at those programs and visiting those programs and seeing how they're affecting our veteran community is truly a powerful, thing to witness. And it's really easy to speak to. So seeing that grow and watching, you know, people, you know, oh, these veterans are going to row across an ocean. Let's follow them on Instagram or let's follow them on the Facebook. It was, you know, we went from zero to 4,000 people. It was kind of cool to see that. But our mission is not changed. Our mission is going to stay the same. And, you know, we just keep growing. So that now that we have all the 2020 or the 2018 team is complete, now it's time to start focusing on the 2019 team. And they carry the same message, you know. It's a new group of veterans, and it's a new group of veterans who see the mission of fight or die. And it's a new group of veterans who want to row an ocean and be able to be the sounding board for what we're trying to do to support our military community. Mm. You know, and the, and so that, you know, that's, we just keep growing and growing in that aspect too. So you got four guys that started in 18, you got four more guys that started in 19. We got four new guys that are starting in 2020. We're going to have four ladies to row in 2020. And then, you know, work with the adaptive athlete program and recruit rowers that want to, athletes that want to row the ocean. I mean, it's going to, this is a sustainable program. So anybody out there that's a veteran, you know, if you're interested in rowing an ocean, you know, our requirements are, we don't have a lot of requirements to be vetted to be an ocean racer. If you say you're going to row an ocean, you're halfway there. You know, it's kind of a mind game. So, you know, all I need is a, you know, proof that you were in the military, which is just a copy of your DD-214 and, you know, a one page bio of who you are and why you want to row an ocean. Mm-hmm. And, that goes through, you know, sort of a selection process, and you know, you're either on the team or you're not, or you're getting pushed to the following year. So, we're really proud of that. And we're super stoked the way these new teams are coming about. And I'm going to step out of the limelight and kind of just manage me and the original crew. We're just going to kind of manage the other teams and let them take the glory. And because it's truly a remarkable race, and there's a lot of media attention that, you know, none of us were ever used to, by any means. We weren't ever used to any of that, right? I mean, I came from, you know, a soft community where we're trained to be quiet. We don't advertise what we do. And so that was kind of a, you know, a learning experience for me and a couple of the others on the team. And, you know, so now it's time for 19 to get out there and promote fight or die, and to promote the Sturm Specialty of Military Psychology and the Marcus Institute of Brain Health, and you know, next year will be, the following year will be 2020. So we're super excited about that.
I love the mission of what you're doing. I love that the purpose behind it, and it's awesome to see how it's grown and how you're now moving from like the rower to kind of the manager and all of that. And one of the things that you said that really resonated was this sense of, you know, you were trained to be quiet in your role in the military, and now you're having to promote and really advocate for this cause. I know that lots of guests I've had on the show have struggled with this in a variety of ways, be it interviewing and kind of speaking on their behalf, or fundraising, which you've had to do a lot of. Do you have any advice for listeners about how to approach this, how to make that switch from being quiet and self-spoken to being able to promote a cause or organization or product or yourself if you believe in it?
Yeah, I think if you draw out, if this is the route you're going to go, first off, social media is a necessity. It's not going anywhere. It's going to become more prolific within our society and our way of life. So, and if you're going to run an organization or start an organization that's, you know, like this, you got to get, you know, you're going to get into it. Because if you don't, you're not going to succeed. So you got to, that was a learning experience for me. And I'm not going to say I don't like it, but it's not my favorite thing to do for fight or die. I'd rather have other people do it. But it's a necessity. You got to have, you can look at some of our fellow veteran companies, for-profit companies that are out there. You know, I go to like Black Rifle Coffee Company. I mean, these, you know, Bison Union, or any, just name a veteran company out there that's promoting themselves via social media, and they went from, you know, a low number EBITDA to a high number EBITDA. So that's something that, you know, I go back to, you got to do it. So I would, if you're going to start it out, you need to have a clear plan. You need to be able to write out, you know, this is my right and my left limit. We're not going to do this. We are going to do this. You know, just come up with your own rules, and just make sure that, you know, they're right. And I would have a professional, somebody that's been in business, or somebody that's, that's in, you know, public marketing or things like that. I would have them look at it and kind of give it a scrub and let you know if you're doing the right thing or not doing the right thing, because they can really help you out. We just brought on our first marketing person, so that's going to be a huge load off of a lot of our shoulders.
That's great. I love that thought of setting limits too, just kind of setting those boundaries at the outset and getting that advice along the way. I think those are both spot on pieces of advice. Well, I always like to leave the last question a little bit more open-ended. And Bryant, I appreciate your perspective on the oil and gas industry and then the work that you're doing right now with your own nonprofit. What have we not covered that you want to make sure listeners know before we wrap up?
Okay, well, I'll just finish talking about the nonprofit stuff. If you're interested in learning more about Fight or Die, you can go to www.usvetro.org. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. That's all Fight or Die, and the or is a pun on words, so it's spelled O-A-R, Fight or Die. Go back to oil and gas. There's a lot of companies, you know, a lot of the oil and gas companies that do, they do travel to military bases. They do try to recruit, military personnel into the industry. You know, I think it's been a blessing to me and to my family, and I highly recommend, going to one of those events if they're ever at any post or base or you know, camp, wherever you are, because there's a lot of word that's out there. It's not going anywhere. Yeah. So continue to evolve, continue to grow as a person, you know, don't stop learning. I mean, I think it's, this has been a growth experience for me over the last 2 years starting a nonprofit. If you would have ever asked me 3 years ago or two years ago, even if I was going to be the head of a nonprofit organization, I would have told you, you're crazy. You know, I was more for-profit corporate focused than anything. And, you know, but there's still that gnawing feeling in your gut that says you got to continue to serve. And so that's where we are right now with Fight or Die. But, you know, just continue to serve and continue to grow as a human, man. That's all you can do.
This is great. And for listeners at beyondtheuniform.org, in the show notes for this episode, I'll have links to Fight or Die and how you can support and donate to contribute to their cause, as well as links to everything else we discussed. Bryant, thank you so much for your time today. Well, thank you so much for listening and for supporting Beyond the Uniform. Beyond the Uniform is produced and edited by me, Justin Asiri. Our staff is entirely part-time. They do this on nights and weekends out of the goodness of their hearts to give back to the military community. Our director of outreach is Steve Bain, who relentlessly books guests, finds sponsors, puts together our newsletter, and thousands of other critical tasks every single week, all behind the scenes to keep Beyond the Uniform running smoothly. Our editor is Kathleen Dillon, who listens to and transcribes every single episode to help out those who don't have the time to listen to the show. It has a major impact on our site's SEO value, which helps people find us through Google. Our data analytics and insights advisor is Andrew Woolridge, who pours over the data each and every month to help us better understand how to best serve the Beyond the Uniform audience. Our digital production work is done by Michael Cummings, who puts together custom artwork for every episode. If you're enjoying Beyond the Uniform, the best way to help us out is by telling your friends and fellow service members and veterans. iTunes reviews, believe it or not, have a big impact on getting the word out as well. So if you have a chance to leave a positive review, that is greatly appreciated. If you know of a business that would like to get their product or service in front of a military audience, we are always on the lookout for sponsors, which helps us subsidize the cost of putting this show together. And if you haven't yet signed up for our newsletter, you can do so at beyonduniform.io. We send out a newsletter twice a month, and it is a treasure trove of helpful information for your civilian career and transition. And be sure to check out our coaching program, where you can be connected with a subsidized, professional, certified executive and career coach to help you in your career decision-making. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back next week with more stories from military veterans about their civilian career. Take care.